Hello and welcome to this week's edition of Use Your Words, Writers Speak. My name is JJ Amaworo-Wilson. I'm your host for today. I'm very happy to say we have Bill Sharland here, a WNMU professor emeritus and an outstanding writer who's published half a dozen books. And most recently, he's published the novel Tenuous State. Bill, welcome to the program.
Thank you, JJ.
How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks.
Good, good. Bill, you have a long history of teaching, writing, and of helping students. You've been in Silver City a while too, right? Is that right?
Yes. We've owned a home here since, I believe, 97, and I began teaching at Western in the summers in 99 as a way to get to know the community to see if we actually wanted to live here. And I found I loved the school and so continued to teach here in the summers. And so I have a long history at Western, and we've lived here actually for about 15, 16 years.
Right. Okay. Let's talk about your new book, Tenuous State. What is Tenuous State about? Would you like to tell us?
Well, I think about it on a couple of levels. It's about the fight for diversity in higher education. It's about a small half Hispanic university in the Southwest, which is fighting for its identity over against a so-called education reform movement that would try to make it the same as everywhere else. And I actually have a bit of a description of the book that I'd like to read.
Okay,
is this
excellent.
A good time?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay, let me do that. It'll just take a minute.
Yep.
Tenuous State is a story of empowerment and survival. That's the message in the climate of these times. Set in a small half-Hispanic university in the Southwest, the novel echoes the anxieties of higher education. One analyst from Harvard has predicted that half the 4,000 colleges and universities in the U.S. will shut down within the next 10 to 15 years. Together with watching out for its survival, Ocotillo U must be wary of a so-called education reform movement that could undermine its identity. Its agenda is conformity, same as standardized tests in the public schools. This university must fight for diversity in higher education. Into our story comes Connor Ransom, a 30-year-old professor of religion at OCU, fresh out of graduate school, and before that, a career change out of a tumultuous couple of years in the parish ministry. Connor, who will narrate the tale, is an idealistic academic who looks forward to a long career of teaching in a peaceful environment till he finds that his position is to be eliminated because of low enrollment along with his department. The solution to his problem, he learns from President Walter Driscoll, is to assume whether Dr. Driscoll's current jobs and become dean of the faculty, albeit in just his second semester of teaching. Our narrator is woefully ill-equipped for his position and haunted by some traumas from the past. Connor is pretty shaky, but he's aided by a couple of able mentors from the university. Dr. Wiley Crane, once a star basketball player at Ocotillo U, got hooked on history and went on to earn a doctorate at Northwestern University. Wiley has been back on the faculty at OCU for 8 years, but he's not left his own history behind. While he speaks the argot of college profs, he's apt to lapse into street talk. Teresa Ramirez is a sleek Latina journalism professor in her first year at OCU and full of questions, as is Connor. The two strike up a friendship that turns romantic as they investigate the university and its enigmatic president, Walter Driscoll. Slowly, Connor learns more about the many sides of Teresa, a native New Mexican, Mount Holyoke grad, with an obscure romantic history of her own. Meanwhile, Walter Driscoll, Connor's boss and mentor, disappears. In time, as a search is conducted, and as Connor ponders his fate, a new president is named. The choice is immense enough to send him reeling. It is Sterling Holmes, the senior minister and his boss from his brief career in the clergy. Sterling, it seems, has undergone a career change of his own with a newly minted doctorate from a school in Florida and a new Hispanic wife whose surname doubtless helped him get this job. He is now Dr. Sterling Holmes Ortega. What has not changed, Connor will discover, is Sterling's compulsive, head-in-the-clouds pursuit of a private vision in his work. In this case, it seems his calling is to subject OCU to every kind of assessment he can find, turning it into the accountable university and a bland mainstream school in the process. Connor will find himself contending with his old boss, whose appearance is complicated by that of Lisa Nordine, a sociologist and lover from back in the parish, who needs a job at OCU very badly. Will Connor help her, and where will that lead? Along the way, we'll find some incredible stories of education reform eviscerating the profession of education. First, a bilingual elementary school serving hundreds of students crossing the border from Mexico each day, yet given an F by the state based on ungainly standardized test scores. Second, a state university driven to pay instructors cash bonuses for retaining students in their classes, regardless of how they were doing, in order to secure funding. What's incredible about these stories, along with much of tenuous state, is that they are true.
Thank you, Bill. I found it to be a wonderful novel, funny, sexy, serious, full of intrigue, actually really quite gripping, which is not what I expected of what is really a campus novel. But it was full of surprises. I have a question for you. The book obviously references a university very close to us. I'm just wondering, did you feel nervous about writing it or that people you know would read it?
At first I did. Yeah. And I had cooked up another title for it, but I got brave at the end and called it Tenuous State. Mm-hmm. The more research I did about higher education after I'd finished the novel, I realized the tenuous state, and I thought of it as a kind of a double entendre, you know, Oklahoma State, Florida State,
sure.
Tenuous state. And I was a little bit nervous about applying this title to a school that was obviously so close to home.
Yep.
But the further I went on in looking into research on the state of higher education today, it seemed that the title applies to the whole industry.
Yes.
And so I eased up. I was much less nervous as we went on.
The book is rich with the ins and outs of university life, isn't it? With the meetings and discussions of tenure and et cetera, et cetera. How much is fact and how much is fiction?
I would say very little is fiction. I concluded in reflection at one point, maybe after I'd finished the story, that looking back at the time when I first got into higher education, and that was my last year at Yale Divinity School, I took on a fieldwork assignment as Protestant chaplain at, what's the name of the place? You know, I've spaced on the name of the school, but it was a school in Hamden, Connecticut, a suburb of New Haven. And it's become fairly well known for its polling services today. But anyway, that was my entry to higher education. It was in 1961. Mm-hmm. And I finally retired from higher education in 2011. as director of the honors program here at Western. And I'd worked part-time at Western in retirement. I was about 65 when I started here for about 10 years, enjoying it very much. I loved Western. So that was 50 years, and I'd been in and out of higher education that whole time.
Yeah,
and it had given me a perspective on all the changes and the reinventions going on in the field throughout that time. So I had seen a great deal, and almost all of this, the ins and outs and the stratagems, the ploys, are things I've seen.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And it really comes through in the writing. There's a sense of authenticity about it. Connor Ransom, your hero, you describe him as an idealistic academic. Does that have any relation to you or you in a former incarnation?
I'd say that the character is very autobiographical.
Right, right.
Very much so, you know, and including the first 2 years in the ministry. I mean, that's my that's my history. I started out as a campus minister in a parish setting for the first couple of years. And that those experiences in particular are very, very autobiographical, including the senior minister who faked his Easter data, set out 10 fewer chairs.
That was real?
Yeah, that was real.
Right.
Yeah, so that character is highly autobiographical.
Right, right. I guessed as much. I was very interested in the fact that you write excellent women characters, which is notoriously difficult for male authors. Probably the same the other way around. I think women authors sometimes have difficulty writing it from a male perspective. But your women are very strong, very convincing, particularly Teresa. And is it Alice? Prendergast, is that her name?
The older secretary.
Yeah, the secretary, yeah, yeah. They're very convincing, powerful characters. I'm wondering, was that tricky for you? How did you go about writing female characters?
You know, I'm not at all aware, and my experience in writing fiction, and this is the third time I've tried it, is that I'll generally start out with one character in mind, and that's the narrator, and the other characters just seem to appear, and the story evolves from their interaction. So, for example, the character of Wiley Crane, I've never known anyone specifically like that. You know, I've known elements of that character, but no one specifically like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And those characters take over the story so that I become something of an observer.
Yes.
I'm sure you know that process.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So same with the women characters.
Same with the women.
Yeah,
yes.
I don't know.
Okay. We're going to take a little break. You are listening to Use Your Words, Writers Speak. This is J.J. Amawuro-Wilson interviewing Bill Sharland. And please join us again in a minute or two. Hello again. You are listening to Use Your Words, Writers Speak. I am J.J. Amawuro-Wilson, and I am interviewing Bill Sharland today, author of Tenuous State. Bill, I have a couple of other questions about, not just about this book, but also about the whole process of writing and your sort of existence as a writer. I'm wondering, do you feel that you are a part of a literary community here in Silver City, or are you more of a lone wolf writer?
I think the times that I've been a part of a community was in journalism. And when I retired from Western, I got involved with the Silver City Sun News when it had a local presence, and became good friends with Susan Dunlap, who was the editor. And for about 3 years, I was a general assignment reporter, which is something I'd never done. I'd been a columnist and a freelance feature writer in Denver, but I'd never done this sort of thing of going out on assignment, and it was very good for me. It's a real learning experience. And working with Susan, that gave me a real sense of community and participation.
Yeah.
Yeah. But as far as other book writers, you know, I've enjoyed getting to know you and I've not really been part of that community, I don't think.
No. What do you think of the whole rigmarole that goes around marketing a book? Because you're supposed to go to conferences and events and do readings. Is this something you enjoy, or is it a chore?
I don't enjoy it. Right. We've done a lot of it here, and I got involved. Barry Hotvedt gave me a couple of very good suggestions for support people, and they've done a wonderful job in helping me to market the book in Silver City. Mm-hmm. I've got a lot of difficulty in trying to identify ways to reach a higher education audience nationally.
Yes.
And I'm going to be spending the winter again in Tucson, and we'll attempt to do some marketing there. But I think in Silver City, we've done a wonderful job of presenting the job. I've done many readings and so forth here. On Sunday, I'll be doing speaking at the Unitarian Universalist Church service. So that's been pleasant, really. But ordinarily, I don't enjoy promoting myself.
No, sure.
So that's a drawback.
Yeah. I think many writers feel the same, actually. That
yes.
A lot of us are really lone wolves,
yes.
In a sense. What does literary success look like to you? What would you consider to be a success, particularly for this book, Tenuous State?
I think to help people reflect the industry, the profession of higher education, how it has been changing. And particularly those who are involved in the profession currently, to look at what they're doing. One of the anecdotes in the book that I've used in presentations and had people enact is the presence of high school students in college classes. And this has actually been quite a revolutionary trend. If you ask people over age, maybe 55, if they had an opportunity to earn college credit while they were in high school, no hands will go up.
Yeah.
This is a very recent trend. But this is a very, very important component of the enrollment for a typical university such as Western.
Yeah.
So it's an example, along with the online course industry, of how this industry is changing. And, of course, it's been affected in a negative way by public policy innovations that have been really disastrous, such as forcing the university at one point to pay instructors cash bonuses to retain students in classes,
yes,
so that they can continue to receive a certain level of funding.
Yeah,
I mean, that has been a real disaster, the prostitution of the profession.
Yeah,
and just to help people reflect on what they're a part of and what's going on.
Yes, absolutely. Bill, you've written in several different genres. We've already talked a little bit about your journalism. But you also wrote several books before you came to fiction, didn't you?
Yes.
Would you like to tell us just a little bit about them so we know a little bit more about your background as a writer?
Right. Well, I started writing for publication really in high school. I was part of a very good high school newspaper. I wrote editorials and received a little recognition there. Mm-hmm. Edited my college paper. Gosh. I started with academic writing, I guess, which I thought was the easiest form. My first book I wrote for a course that I was teaching for adults returning to school, and it was a book on ethics and adult psychology called Decide to Live, Adult Approaches to Values. And I wrote that because I couldn't find a text for the course. And that was my entree to published trade books, I guess you would say.
Yeah.
And I wrote six of those, and they had to do with midlife adult issues. And I was working primarily with adults returning to school. The bulk of them had to do with career issues. That was where my attention gravitated.
So how did you come to fiction?
Gosh. The small school that I had graduated from in South Dakota, a denominational school, went bankrupt in the early 2000 era, and was, through a lot of chicanery, was taken over by the U.S. Bureau of Prisons and became a minimum security prison. And I was so aggrieved by that, and I didn't think anyone else would really care, that I wrote a story about it. And that became my first novel. And I had a close friend in Denver who was a novelist, and he took me under his wing, and another friend who had been an English professor. These people mentored me in that first novel, which is, I think, is really pretty good. It's on my website, and I'll plug that. It's okay. BillSharlin.com. It's called The Heartland File. And then I, when I left Denver, I was teaching in Mexico for a while. I looked back on that period, and it was the time of a high-tech boom in Denver.
Yes.
And I wrote a novel called Soundings on that experience. And so I guess I'd got into the habit of looking back on experiences that I'd had.
Yes.
And writing novels about them, and then this was the third try at that.
And it seems you are inspired by certain issues that are going on in society, in this case, in the world of higher education. And obviously your first novel was through outrage at the place being turned into a prison, I guess. Would that be fair to say?
Yes.
You're spurred on by these issues?
Yes. Somewhere I read a quote, and I've never been able to find the source, and it said, all writing is enraged.
Very good.
And I think that certainly we have to have a high level of energy and irritation about something to write well, particularly in fiction. And that's true for me. This is what I would call San Luis State and my other novels, a novel of social concern.
Excellent. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a good way of putting it. Social concern. Yeah. Bill, do you have a little extract you'd like to read before we finish?
Yes. I thought it would be fun to read this. This is the first time I've tried this, but this is a little excerpt toward the end of the book.
Great. Okay.
A couple of days ago, I went back down to Palomas, and I timed my trip to coincide with the kids getting out of school in Columbus. Now, I imagine some of you know there are many children in Palomas who were born in Deming, site of the nearest hospital, and so they are American citizens and are eligible to attend elementary school in Columbus. Hundreds of them cross the border every day to do so. A few dozen others are bused to high school in Deming. That elementary school in Columbus is one of the most amazing institutions in our country. And do you know where the teachers come from, do you? There were a few shouts from the stands. My character is giving a commencement address. That's right, almost the entire faculty of the Columbus Elementary School, teachers who work every day with Mexican kids, are graduates of Ocotillo U. Can we give them a hand for all they do? A rousing applause. So one more anecdote and I'm done. I was standing there in Palomas about 3 o'clock and the students were coming back across the border. And first it was the high school kids. A couple strolled by holding hands. And then a young guy came running up, approached the statue, and swatted Pancho Villa's horse on the balls. I let the laughter die down. And then came the dozens and dozens of kids from the elementary school, waves of them. One little girl caught my eye. She was running along, skipping, holding a sheet of construction paper with a drawing on it and some text, something in English, I guess, her lesson for the day. And she was so excited to show her parents what she had done, and her eyes were shining, and my eyes started brimming. And I choked up, and for a moment I had to stop. Well, I was just thinking again of the work of that school and our graduates. But then a cloud came over me, and I remembered the work of the state of New Mexico to rank all the schools of the state and give them each a letter grade based solely on the students' standardized test scores. So one more point, friends, and then I'm out of your hair. Can you guess what grade the bureaucrats awarded the elementary school in Columbus for the work they have been doing with those kids from Palomas? That's right, amigos, you've got it. They gave that school an F. That was my experience.
That's terrific. What a terrific extract.
And I started to cry when that little girl came by with her assignment.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's pretty much why I wrote Strenuous State.
Fantastic. On that note, we will close. So you've been listening to Use Your Words, Writers Speak. I am J.J. Amawuro-Wilson. I've had the great privilege of interviewing Bill Sharland, the author of Tenuous State, A Tale of Survival in the West. Bill, just tell us, where can we buy a copy of this?
It's available on Amazon.
On Amazon. And your website is?
Bill Sharland is one word, billsharland.com.
Yep, and that's Sharland with a C, Bill.
Yes.
As in the French, Charlon. Is that right? All right. Thank you very much for joining us, Bill.
Thank you.